WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by T-Mobile Business Advantage.
I'm Michael Wallace. 30 people were injured when a car rammed into a crowd on Santa Monica Boulevard in East Hollywood.
At least 7 are in critical condition this morning, 6 in serious condition, 10 minor injuries.
CBS News Los Angeles reporter Elise Martinez is at the scene.
Initial reports from LA City firefighters on scene indicate the driver may somehow have lost consciousness, hitting a taco truck and a valet stand and striking the crowd.
Many of the victims were waiting to get into a nightclub. President Trump has filed a $10 billion libel lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal over its story about Trump's alleged bawdy birthday letter to Jeffrey Epstein. The Justice Department has asked a New York court to unseal grand jury transcripts from Epstein's sex trafficking case. More from CBS's Wendy Gillette.
After pushing back on calls from Democrats and many supporters to reveal more about the Epstein case, the president ordered new disclosures of information. Federal prosecutors complied yesterday, asking a judge to unseal grand jury transcripts. Trump supporter Stephen Taylor, who lives in western Pennsylvania, says he wants to see more.
We put you in office. You ran on this platform. You offered it. We didn't ask for it. And now we want it. We demand it.
The 24 million Americans insured under the Affordable Care Act may see big premium increases next year and a sharp drop in the federal subsidies most of them rely on to buy their coverage. CBS News chief medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook.
KFF, a health policy research group, says the loss of some tax credits will drive up out-of-pocket payments by over 75%. The Congressional Budget Office projects at least 4 million people will lose their coverage.
Microsoft has announced it'll stop using Chinese engineers for cloud support for the Department of Defense. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered an internal review after a risk was detected.
It turns out that some tech companies have been using cheap Chinese labor to assist with DoD cloud services. This is obviously unacceptable.
Hegseth says it was a legacy system created over a decade ago during the Obama administration. He says China will no longer have any involvement in those cloud services. Researchers have found one reason why millions of bees have died over the last year. CBS News Sacramento reporter Dominic Garcia.
The new USDA report shows mites that infect hives have become immune to chemicals that are used to control them, specifically a chemical called amitraz. Other factors like climate and pesticides have not helped.
The loss of so many bees is impacting agricultural production across the country. Bees help pollinate a lot of crops. This is CBS News.
If you're 55 and up, T-Mobile has plans built just for you. Right now, you can save big with T-Mobile's phone and home internet bundle. Visit your local store to learn more.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
For Civic Media News, I'm Charlie Pittman. A nonprofit in northeastern Wisconsin serves people with major disabilities, but it's getting mixed messages from lawmakers on whether the families it serves will be impacted by federal Medicaid cuts. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection reports.
The nonprofit CP serves about 200 people in northeast Wisconsin that have complex physical or developmental disabilities, nearly all of whom use Medicaid to pay for their services. Julie Tesloff is the director of adult day services and says about 75% of clients are in wheelchairs and unable to reposition themselves. She explains the exercise program CP offers is crucial to prevent patients from developing pressure sores.
A sore on the butt costs a lot of money. It's like anywhere from $30,000 to $150,000. And once one of our clients has a pressure sore, it stays with them for a long time.
She says their program focuses on functional skills training using adaptable equipment funded through grants and community support. Tesloff says most of their clients are deemed to have a level of disability that could place them in a nursing home, and most are poor. About half live with their parents, who she says can easily experience burnout. She explains the day services provide respite for these caregivers and prevent costly monthly nursing home placements for clients. Starting December of 2026, most Medicaid recipients will be required to complete at least 80 hours per month of work, schooling, or community service to retain coverage. There are exceptions, but it's not clear if they will apply to people caring for an adult with a disability. John Sindergaard, executive director at CP, says lawmakers have assured them that their clients won't be impacted.
But then in the next breath, they're all telling us that they can't necessarily be certain about that because they don't know the details. And in many cases, it's sobering to say that they haven't even worked their way through all of the legislation yet.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. By this afternoon, we'll have mostly sunny skies and highs in the upper 70s. For tonight, partly cloudy, a low around 55. Sunny on Sunday with a high near 80. Sunday night, slight chance of a shower, 59. Slight chance of a storm Monday with a high around 80. Currently, 69 degrees.
Jay Matt Nair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we are back from our road trip across Wisconsin, back to recap all of the weekend news. Don't miss it.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour in our weekly weekend review of all things rule of law and justice related. We have spent our first hour with you this weekend talking, as we often do, about the decisions of appellate courts and district courts, including those district courts that continue to be the bastion of justice and rule of law in America, finding based upon their review of the facts and of the law that various executive orders, not all of them, it's not universal, it's not across the board, but many of them, most of them issued by the president in various areas do not withstand constitutional review. Indeed, just this past week, judges telling the president that he cannot enforce his orders with respect to the International Criminal Court, can't in fact fire a board member, a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission, and cannot pursue his executive order with respect to birthright citizenship. That, of course, like the other cases, all of them going to be receiving more attention by the judiciary. All of that, a part of the rule of law and a part of the president's view that he has got this capacity as the chief executive to do all of these things, encouraged an awful lot by a Congress that does not do oversight on any of this and is not engaging in any way when the president oversteps his bounds with respect to their authority to establish the laws of our land, including various agencies, certainly being given the green light by our United States Supreme Court. We'll talk about that more in just a few moments when we talk about the many cases in which the Supreme Court, without decision-making description, is telling our president to go right ahead and do what he needs to do as the president of the United States of America. In all of this, we appreciate so much the comments, written and also oral, from our listeners. Appreciate very much Mark writing in from Perry Drusac, saying that in connection with many of these orders, he says Trump is not the law. His sworn duty is to take care that the laws of our Constitution, of our government, be faithfully executed. Again, he says, shall in law means must. Apparently, there are members of the Supreme Court, like the president himself, and of course others, who miss that point. And indeed, Mark, that is a great concern. That's one of the challenges. It's the reason why we have the constitutional crisis that we have had at least since March of this year. Appreciate very much that comment. Also, calling in from Madison, we've got Dick. Dick, appreciate very much your being a part of our broadcast this weekend again.
Thanks for taking my call. Real quick on the Epstein situation.
Yes.
You know, all of a sudden now we're going to release this or documents pertinent to it. I believe those documents pertinent to it that might imply that there's something incriminating about the president. I think those are probably already in the bathroom at Mar-a-Lago. I really don't see us seeing anything coming out of her that's going to indicate that he's involved. It's going to turn into something that it totally isn't, in my mind. I wouldn't trust it at all.
Mm-hmm. And, Dick, we're going to talk about that at great length. I agree with you for all sorts of legal reasons as well. There may be the political reasons or maybe the historical reasons you've just identified. There are some other reasons why this particular direction from the president to the attorney general to get to release all of these documents. Well, it's very particular. It's about a direction to get grand jury materials. And we'll talk about whether or not there's merit to that request at all, whether a district court judge will indeed grant that. And beyond that, the question, I think I hear it in your voice, I hear it in the substance and the tone, Dick, is what are we doing here? Why are we doing this? What to what end does all of this reach? We'll talk more about that, Dick. Appreciate very much the comment at the end of this hour. So stay with us for that discussion as well. And Dick, appreciate your teasing that for our future discussion. We want to spend some time talking about, once again, the United States Supreme Court. We have spent a huge amount of time talking about its merits docket. That is the 67 cases that it decided this past term, the 2024-2025 term. 67 different decisions, rulings, things that it has authored with explanations and following the submission of briefs and oral arguments and consideration by the justices over long periods of time, weeks and months, resulting in opinions that are 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 pages long, explaining why it is they're doing what they're doing. We've got majority opinions, we've got dissenting opinions, and the point of all that, of course, is there is transparency, to use that word, that's all important today, as it has always been in America, when it comes to understanding what our judges and our justices are doing. And we've talked a lot about those merits cases in the past, even while these, what I'll refer to them as the shadow docket cases, have also been proceeding. Those are different in number and they're different in process than are the merits cases that we have talked about, including things like birthright citizenship, including last week that long discussion that we had appropriately about the intersection of religion and academics there in Maryland and throughout the United States of America. Many other cases also on the docket of the court of this past term. Those are all merits cases subject to this careful analysis and review, producing something that we may disagree with. We may agree with it. We may disagree with what the Supreme Court says in the end. But in the end, you know why it is they're saying what they're saying, even if we disagree with the disposition itself or even the reasons for coming to it. The great difference is what is called the shadow docket, this emergency application procedure. And according to my count, that of many others, we're approaching about 20 of these applications, even since January 20 of this year. In the last 6 months or so, situations where this administration, through the Office of the Solicitor General, his name is John Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. We've talked a lot about him. He's your representative before the United States Supreme Court. He authors these briefs. He presents these arguments to the Supreme Court almost 20 different times, 18, 19 different times in recent months. He has said to the Supreme Court that even though there is litigation pending in the lower district courts and the appeals courts, and we've heard about both of them already today on this very broadcast, even while that's going on, even while they have not resolved the underlying merits of those cases, the causes of action, the challenges that have brought people into place, the judgments are not yet done. Supreme Court intervene and direct that the president be permitted to do what he wants to do inside those cases, to go ahead with the executive orders that are the very subjects of the challenges in those cases. That's the emergency application doctrine, if you will. And it has been invoked with breakneck speed in this administration, in this Supreme Court, that has on at least nine times in the past several weeks alone issued orders, unsigned, with virtually no explanation whatsoever, no sense of who is saying what about the merits of the case. In many of these cases, we get a sense of who the dissenters are, because they articulate their views, but they are not in the majority. And we don't have a sense, we don't have any feel for why it is the Supreme Court, again, intervening in these lower cases, telling the president that even while his very policies and executive orders are subject to review at the lower courts, which is how our process contemplates review. Even while that's going on, you may go ahead and do the thing that you have directed be accomplished by virtue of your executive order. What are those kinds of things? All kinds of things. That is firings and cessation of monies flowing with respect to transgender rights, kicking people out of the United States military, doing things with respect to funding across universities and colleges. The list is legion. And the Supreme Court, again, in this emergency application docket and pursuing this so-called shadow docket doctrine, has been giving the president the okay to proceed. We're going to talk about that because, once again, it's back in our national attention. About a week or so ago, we commented and reported at great length about this major decision right after the 4th of July, giving the president authority to go ahead to slash the federal workforce, dismantle federal agencies across the board based upon an executive order that he issued months earlier, directing all of his federal agencies around the cabinet, and yes, again, beyond his authority, directing all of them to begin to identify those places where these federal workforces can be dramatically reduced. He issued that by virtue of an executive order. And finally, again, in early part of this month, in early July, the Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, go ahead and do that. The order lifting a lower court ruling that had blocked those mass layoffs and said, Mr. President, you cannot do that. The order from the Supreme Court, again, in connection with this emergency docket, unsigned, does not include a vote count, and it is therefore the shadow docket. We'll talk in a moment about where that word comes from. It's typical in these emergency applications, and we know that in that particular case, it was lone Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson who wrote a very public dissent objecting to this, and talking about how it's not this court's role to swoop in and second guess a lower court's factual finding. She said, no one seriously disputes that the president's executive order would lead to enormous real-world consequences, including the dismantling of much of the federal government as Congress has created it. That's what the sole dissenter, Ketanji Brown Jackson, said a couple of weeks ago when the Supreme Court affirmed on this shadow docket, without an explanation, the permission it was giving to the president to go ahead and slash these workforces. And we've seen that, of course, before, during, and certainly after that particular order. Indeed, we've seen people leaving the State Department about a week or so ago, long-tenured representatives, long-tenured Foreign Service officers there at C Street, leaving the State Department upon the direction of the Secretary of State, pursuant to the authority given to the Secretary by the President and affirmed by the United States Supreme Court. And we talked about the consequences of that, as Ketanji Brown Jackson identified. Just this past week, early this past week, more of that. Supreme Court agreeing on Monday, again, by virtue of its emergency docket, that Donald Trump and the President of the United States of America can, in fact, proceed with dismantling what? The Education Department, long a target, both in the campaign and during his presidency to this date. Dismantle the Education Department by firing more than 1,000 people. Go ahead and do that, Mr. President. That's what the Supreme Court said just this past Monday. The Trump administration, again, had previously announced its plans for about 1,300 people from the Department of Education. That's a significant portion. That's about a quarter, actually more than a quarter. It's 4,000 employees there at the Department of Education. This is a part of the president's effort, the initiative, sometimes embraced by the so-called Musk group or Musk team, to bring dramatically down the federal government's overall role in the nation's, in this place, schools around the country. The Education Department, again, on the target of the president by virtue of his directive to the Secretary of Education to reduce that workload, affirmed, given the green light by the Supreme Court. It undeniably, as in all of these situations, represents a dramatic expansion of presidential power. We talked before about the fact that this is a part of this unified executive theory where the president has authority to do anything that's not exclusively and narrowly legislative and is not exclusively judicial in nature. He has talked already about the fact that if there's any decision made about what the law is, And it is contrary to what his view is in any of these agencies. That law is not effective, and his is. When we come back, we'll talk more about the impact of what the Supreme Court has done in this emergency docket and why it affects our day-to-day lives here in the United States of America as our broadcast continues.
The Tap.
Veterans, have you explored your benefits lately? As in, really looked at them? Veterans who bravely served our country deserve the benefits they've earned and life-saving support when they need it. We know that no one can do this alone, and we're stronger when we work together. The Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs stands ready to serve Wisconsin veterans, their families, and their survivors. With our network of partners, like your local county veteran service officer, we can help connect veterans with services such as education, employment, mental health services, veteran ID, long-term care, and more. We stand ready to serve you. For more information, call 1-800-WIS-VETS or visit WISVETS.com. That's WISVETS.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, with funding provided by the Milwaukee Brewers and the Brewers Community Foundation.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
I've been trying to learn sheepshead for 40 years. My father-in-law is still a card counter, knows what everybody has. It is so easy to go, oh gosh, I still don't know who the partner is, and is that a trump card or is it not? And so I'm still asking myself all these questions while they're busy taking all of my nickels. The one thing that got me where they allow me to play is getting the app. For all the technology that's out there, that is one of the positive notes.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Being blind doesn't look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support.
Learn more at fightingblindness.org. A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
This is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review. We are talking now necessarily once again about the so-called shadow docket, this mechanism through which the United States Supreme Court, with increasing speed, increasing numbers, is agreeing to hear, although even that verb is inappropriate, to entertain appeals while the underlying litigation is going on of various issues, attacking the very soul and core of our normal process in the adjudication, the litigation, the contests over how it is our government should work. We know that just this past week, once again, on Monday, the Supreme Court permitted Donald Trump to basically dismantle the Education Department in a major unsigned order, a single four-sentence paragraph that was entirely devoted to the procedural mechanisms of pausing the lower court's ruling that had said the president cannot, in fact, accomplish these firings about 1,000 people from the Education Department. The Supreme Court, while that underlying litigation is still going on, saying that, yes, Donald Trump can terminate these employment situations, these employment relationships with all of those Department of Education employees, and clearing the way for doing this in this instance and many others. The count is at least in the teens, depending upon how you count them, depending upon how you regard them. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of those in just a moment or so. The reality is that this is transforming American government and American justice. Issuing these orders that lack a fundamental core characteristic of all of those other cases decided this past term, the 67 or so of those, and that is no explanation of the rationale. And we are meant to guess, we are left to guess on what it is the Supreme Court is really saying. The order, again, with respect to the Department of Education, typical of these situations, does not include any explanation of why the majority of the court ruled as it did. It was plainly an exercise of power and authority. They can do this. They are the Supreme Court under the Constitution, but plainly not reason. The silence about exactly what is going on here in the Supreme Court, underscored by the fact that there was, again, a major dissent, this time joined in by two other justices. It is written by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. It's 19 pages, as opposed to the virtually no pages written by the majority explaining their decision. 19 pages written by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined in by Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and here's what she says. She says the majority is either willfully blind to the implications of its ruling or naive. But either way, Justice Sotomayor says, the threat to our Constitution's separation of powers is grave. She says the question of whether the nation's highest court owes the public an explanation for its actions has plainly grown. And she is concerned about it. She says that we're using these truncated procedures to produce these very terse and nondescriptive orders. They're provisional. They're interim. They're not meant to be permanent, but they are sure are having their effect to remain in effect. The president's executive orders that he's issued, while once again, the underlying courts are adjudicating whether those executive orders are legitimate or not. And the upshot, as Justice Sotomayor says, is that those interim orders, those emergency orders, effectively resolve the case. The court, as we know, has allowed this administration to do many, many things. Again, my count, well into the teens under this emergency docket, including things like firing tens of thousands of workers. We've talked about some of those already. Discharging transgender troops. Again, that underlying litigation's still going on, but permitting the president and the Secretary of Defense to terminate the work, the service, longstanding, honorable, no indication of anything dishonorable in any way compromising the outstanding professionalism of our transgender troops, fire them. And they are gone. And they are gone on this emergency docket. Ending protections for literally hundreds of thousands of migrants from these war-torn countries around the world. Fundamentally shifting power again from the capacity of the Congress to decide these cases to the president. That was the Temporary Protective Service program that was in place that protected people who came here because of fear for their lives, and now exposing them to deportation. Again, all of this with no or virtually no explanation or very scant explanation of how it arrived at those results. Some calculations, again, lots of people looking at this. Last 10 weeks alone, this is according to a Georgetown professor named Stephen Vladek. He's very reputable. He wrote all about this in a book called The Shadow Docket. It is years old, but it's excellent in terms of explaining what this is all about. He keeps track of this, as do other entities out there. He says the last 10 weeks alone, the court has granted this emergency relief to the administration without explanation seven times. And he talks about the massive real-world implications when the justices are not telling us the reasons for what they're doing. Again, this is different from the so-called merits docket. We can still, and we should, in appropriate circumstances, disagree with the Supreme Court. We should, in appropriate circumstances, agree with its dispositions. But we can do that based upon an understanding of what they're saying and the explanations for what they're doing. That's what what's missing in all of this. Now, where did this come from? Well, critics have called this the shadow docket for a long time. It was not original with Professor Vladek. It comes, of course, from a Supreme Court justice herself. And with the arrival of Donald Trump's second administration, has taken on even more heat, more emphasis in the public domain. Justice Elena Kagan first used the term way back in 2021 in criticizing the court's work. The majority had just issued this midnight ruling, remember this, that left in place that Texas law that effectively overturned Roe versus Wade, abortion legitimate, even while the court was still addressing the underlying situation. She came up with the phrase at that time. When we come back, I'll tell you more about that and tell you more about why this is important and what the court may do in the future. Here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
CBS News Brief. 30 people are hurt after a vehicle rammed into a crowd in Los Angeles early this morning. Police say they were waiting to enter a nightclub and some are in critical condition.
They drove through a taco stand, through a valet podium, and then through the crowd of people that were waiting to go inside.
President Trump is suing the Wall Street Journal over a story linking him to the late convicted sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. CBS's Michael Toscano.
The libel lawsuit seeks at least $10 billion in damages. It says the Journal's story about a sexually themed 2003 birthday card allegedly sent to Epstein bearing the future president's signature is, quote, false, defamatory, unsubstantiated.
More than 24 million Americans under the Affordable Care Act are facing a crisis. CBS's Dr. John LaPook with an expert.
Is this the equivalent of an Affordable Care Act repeal?
Yes, absolutely. By one estimate, enrollment will be cut in half.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
The Brewers shut out the Dodgers.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports Baseball.
The Brewers with a 2-0 shutout of the Dodgers last night in Los Angeles. William Contreras behind the plate. 23-year-old right-hander Quinn Priester on the mound kept the Dodgers batters guessing just how good of a performance manager Pat Murphy.
Yeah, he was as good as I've seen him. You know what I mean? And we were going to take him out for Ohtani. And I just felt like he deserved it. He's got 6 innings of shutout going, and I felt like he deserved it, and he would grow a lot from doing this.
Right fielder Sal Frelick is on the 10-day injury list with a grade 1 strained left hamstring. Isaac Collins filled in, got on base in the 5th, and scored the Brewers' first run on a double by Caleb Durbin. Then in the 7th, Durbin, with a solo shot to deep center, sailed over the wall at 410 feet to make it 2-0 Milwaukee. The Brewers have now won 8 in a row. Game 2 against the Dodgers coming up tonight with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. By this afternoon, we'll have mostly sunny skies and highs in the upper 70s. For tonight, partly cloudy, a low around 55. Sunny on Sunday with a high near 80. Sunday night, slight chance of a shower, 59. Slight chance of a storm Monday with a high around 80. Currently, 69 degrees.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Folks just deserve a little bit better than the usual promises that they're getting. But our members of Congress, two of them from here in Wisconsin, recently signed a letter to Canada and said, Canada, you're on fire. You need to do something about this, which is really not necessarily the best course of action when your neighbor's house is burning down is to send a letter complaining about the smoke.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
We've got Chris from Nina. What's your thought this afternoon, Chris?
Oftentimes you have only one set of viewers that will watch Fox News or watch CNN. What I really actually love and respect from all your viewers is the fact that you tend to have viewers that think on both sides of the aisle. To be open-minded, you need to be willing to listen and learn and possibly change your mind. You don't have to change your mind, but just being willing to listen.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at MDA75.org.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Mommy, how come I can't sit in the front seat?
Because I love you and you're just not ready yet.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Love protects. A message from
Teach Wawa.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from Madison, where I welcome director-producer John Roach at Max Inc. Radio's Rocker joins me in studio for some Atwood Fest chat. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Peach Wawa. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a Law Review. We are talking in this, the second hour of our broadcast, all about this thing called the shadow docket. That's the description of it given sort of casually by, yes, indeed, Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. And she does this many years ago in connection with this midnight ruling. Again, an emergency ruling by the Supreme Court a few years back that left in place that Texas law that would effectively overturn Roe versus Wade in the state at a time when Roe versus Wade was still the law of the land. This is before the Dobbs decision. And yes, indeed, the court the following year would adopt, would issue that decision in Dobbs, not without the scathing dissents of the dissenters. But in dissent, at the time that the Supreme Court, even before Dobbs was issued, when it let the Texas law that would have effectively overturned Roe versus Wade, that effectively changed the law with respect to one state in the entire United States Union, she said that the majority's decision is emblematic of too much of this court's shadow docket decision making, which every day becomes more unreasoned, more inconsistent, and impossible to defend. That's where this word comes from. It comes from Justice Elena Kagan describing it as being in the shadows, and again, adopted by authors who've been tracking this kind of thing and by generally the public as a shorthand to explain what the Supreme Court is and, more importantly, is not doing when it comes to making these major decisions. For what it's worth, here's the history on the other side. About a month later, Justice Sam Alito, he recognizes what Justice Kagan has said. He gives a speech at Notre Dame, and he defends the court's approach to these emergency applications. He said the catchy and sinister term shadow docket has been used to portray the court as having been captured by a dangerous cabal that resorts to sneaky and improper methods to get its ways. This portrayal, Justice Alito said, this portrayal feeds unprecedented efforts to intimidate the court and to damage it as an independent institution. He compared, interestingly, this description of what the court has been doing, was doing, is still doing, as what emergency medical technicians face when they come upon the scene of an accident. He said, you can't expect the EMTs and the emergency rooms to do the same thing that a team of physicians and nurses will do when they are handling a matter when time is not of the essence in the same way. And he said, believe it or not, that sometimes it's better to say less than more. And he approached this and said, scant and absent reasoning is sometimes the better course of action. Let's talk about that once again. Again, the reference to medical treatment and care being given is completely inappropriate, of course. You've got life and death decisions. And it raises, as does Justice Kagan and others, the question of where the emergencies are in all of these cases. In some instances, it's an emergency because right now we've got to overturn what have been years, if not decades, of precedential decisions by the court, and we've got to get rid of all sorts of employees inside the Department of Education, the Department of State, other places. On an emergency base, we've got to do it right now. We've got to get rid of the transgender military folks immediately, because why? What is that emergency that would otherwise render it akin to medical care at the time of a scene of an accident? No such emergency in virtually any of these cases. The one instance, as we've talked before, where there is often an emergency, where they have traditionally in years past appropriately invoked this emergency application procedure, is when someone's on death row. And a state where the death penalty is in place is about to execute someone, and a lawyer, maybe several lawyers, petition the Supreme Court to take one more look at the case because you don't have a second chance. And the Supreme Court will sometimes invoke that automatic, that emergency stay to say, wait a minute, give us a couple more days. Do not execute this convict, this defendant, until we've had that time to look at it. Truly a life and death situation. I would offer that virtually all of these others, 10, 15, maybe 20 different applications being presented to the Supreme Court by our Solicitor General in support of the president's executive orders that have to be implemented immediately, even though years and years have been in place. Because why? That the emergency nature of these is simply non-existent, which is the reason why you do have Justice Kagan and Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson writing these scathing dissents, not only about the impact of letting these things go ahead without the complete disposition of the cases at the lower courts, without getting the judgment of a district court reviewed by an appellate court that, well, again, creates a record that can be fully reviewed by a Supreme Court, letting all this go, letting all this happen, dismissing people from their jobs, terminating the financial support that's been going out to various academic and other institutions that have relied upon this for our livelihoods and our lives and our communities. Got to do that right away. Supreme Court, in at least 10, 12, 15 situations coming up on those numbers, has permitted the government to go ahead and have those executive orders issued, not only in their full glory and their full impact, but immediately. And that's what the issue is. Among other illustrations, you may recall well that when this happens, we've got confusion also in the lower courts. Orders without any reasoning, which is what the problem is here, can create that sort of confusion. Maybe not that dismay, but that's head scratching that goes on to the lower courts. You remember, for instance, that the court allowed the Trump administration just a few weeks ago to deport those migrants. This was the South Sudan case, to countries other than their own, without giving them the due process to show that they would, in fact, not know about these countries of their deportation to which they're being deported. They would face the risk of torture, some other dangers. And the litigation was about whether or not that could happen, absent giving these convicted criminals who are in fact being deported the opportunity, the due process opportunity to be heard as the law required. The Supreme Court, giving no reasons, said that, in fact, the administration could go ahead and do this. The lower judge, the lower district court judge who had enjoined that from happening, his name was Brian Murphy, remember this, from Boston, had said, you know, there's nothing about that order gives me any direction. I'm continuing to tell the government not to proceed to deport these 8, 9 or so defendants, these convicts who, again, should be and are going to be deported without giving them the opportunity to show that they would face danger, even torture, in these countries of their ultimate destination. What has to happen is then, because of the lack of certainty, is that everyone scratches their head, and the court's silence again prompts the administration to go back to the Supreme Court days later, seeking clarification of what it meant. And then the court issues a second order. And again, no more than 2 pages, very brief. And that allows the administration to send the men to South Sudan. That's the kind of mess that happens in that instance and in others when you pursue this on a regular basis. It is a reason for concern. We know that the Supreme Court is already administering and reviewing other cases for its next docket, the full docket
on that likely list. We've talked about these things in the past. We've got more applicants coming in. There is an application for the Supreme Court to intervene in a case that could significantly once again reduce the scope of the Voting Rights Act. There's another matter that's taking up this issue about whether or not the Ten Commandments should be inside the schools, the public schools of our nation. Now, the court hasn't granted the appeals in those cases yet, but it underscores the significance of the kinds of things that our Supreme Court is likely going to be taking on in the next term. The importance of those is no less when it comes to all of these other cases, the non-merits cases on which it's giving, to which it's giving short shrift and giving us no reasons. And that is why this is such a great concern. And that's why I'm spending so much time talking about the reasons why Americans of all political persuasions, under all circumstances, should be legitimately concerned about the breakneck speed of the use of this shadow docket, of the use of these emergency applications, because they result in very quick decisions and, perhaps most importantly, no clarity with respect to the disposition of the cases. They, in many cases, bring them to an end because of the effective import, the impact of the decisions themselves, the decisions to support the executive orders of the president. But beyond that, when it comes to understanding the jurisprudence of our Supreme Court, no clarity, no reasons. And that I would offer to you is different from what we have seen in the United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, not without some exception, but it's been limited for well over 200 years. That's the problem, and that is the concern. Among the other concerns, of course, are the impact upon human beings, not only overseas, but also the employment situation here in America, employment situations for even things like those immigrants who are here, perhaps some of them illegally, many of them certainly in those circumstances, all of that raising issues about human beings and their status in this nation. That issue also deep inside the Department of Justice as well. As terminations just this past week happen at the hand of the Attorney General, you know them well. Let's talk about two of them and then some more general considerations here, too. Maureen Comey, C-O-M-E-Y, yes, this is not her principal claim to fame, but yes, indeed, she is. She is the daughter of James Comey, the former director of the FBI. She is a federal prosecutor in her own right. She is an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York who has, by all reports, done an outstanding job in providing professional litigation, professional prosecution efforts, initiatives in the grand jury and in trial courts, including the prosecution of, yes, Sean Combs and, yes, the Maxwell cases in that district. Yes, we're going to get to a bit on Jeffrey Epstein at the end of this hour. She is responsible, with others, for those kinds of prosecutions, and she is let go, apparently at the direct direction of the President of the United States of America, through Pam Bondi, who says that you're fired. And she walks out of the U.S. Attorney's Office as an assistant United States attorney. She is not an at-will employee. And she, of course, directs and tells her colleagues who remain behind that this is the conduct of a tyrant. And, of course, we have not heard the last from her. Likely, like many others, she will appeal that removal to the Merit Systems Protection Board. She does have protections. You can't simply do these kinds of things with people who are in those positions. But she is not alone. We know that in addition to her, the attorney general has also fired the ethics chief, the individual who is the head of the Office of Ethics inside the Department of Justice. That is no small thing. The ethics official who's been there a long time, like the Assistant United States Attorney Comey. His name is Joseph Terrell, T-R-R-R-E-L-L. He was told about this. He took to LinkedIn on Monday to tell colleagues about his removal. And he said, until Friday evening, I was the senior ethics attorney at the Department of Justice, responsible for advising the attorney general and the deputy attorney general directly on federal employee ethics. I was also responsible, he said, for the day-to-day operation of the ethics programs across the department. And that means just what it says and says what it means. He is now gone. And he is also terminated, also plainly subject to protections But he is no longer working there, and the president terminating these people without authority. And indeed, the president and the attorney general, we know, also firing other groups of attorneys. We know about their terminations of large numbers of people who were involved in the January 6th prosecutions. They have now terminated virtually the entire staff of those people responsible for the prosecutions of Donald Trump in recent years. All of that coming out of the Department of Justice just this past week and beyond. When we come back, we'll tell you more about that and then talk about this other major issue that is before the American population here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The Wisconsin Elections Commission issued a highly critical report of the City of Madison's former clerk after investigating how 193 mail-in ballots were left uncounted after the 2024 general election. The clerk was suspended by the city, then subsequently resigned. November 12th, a staff member alerted City Clerk Mary Beth Witzel Bell that a sealed ballot courier bag had been found, but Witzel Bell allegedly gave the staff no instructions to open or otherwise investigate, did not alert state or county officials, and went on vacation the next day. Just before Thanksgiving, unaware that an unopened bag had been found, an elections inspector reported a discrepancy in wards 56 and 65. December 2nd, inspectors found another unopened courier bag containing 125 uncounted ballots. The 400-page report found several leadership and procedural failures. It concluded, quote, rather than acknowledge these significant errors, the city clerk and her staff either ignored the issue or willfully refused to inform the necessary parties and seek assistance. These actions resulted in nearly 200 lawful voters' votes going uncounted, an unconscionable result, unquote. The report orders the City of Madison to complete several procedural reforms before the next statewide election in February 2026. We've linked to the full report at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In a chaotic and somewhat discombobulating end to the process, Wisconsin lawmakers passed a state budget and Governor Tony Evers signed it into law at about 1:30 a.m. on July 3rd. What made this budget different from the others signed in this era of divided government is that Democratic votes were needed to pass the budget in the state Senate. Part of the reason that was made possible is because of new, fairer maps. Last November, Senate Democrats flipped four seats, shrinking the Republican majority to just an 18-15 margin. Now, candidates are already lining up to take this the rest of the way and flip the chamber. Democrat Janet Jacobson, who currently serves in the Assembly, is now running for Senate, challenging Republican Howard Markline in the 17th District. If Democrats can flip that district and one more seat, they could control the state Senate for the first time in more than 15 years. That would be a big deal for state politics in Wisconsin.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area. Matt Nair on air.
Author of America, Let Me In, Felipe Torres Medina is here.
My funny book about immigration. You can see how the current administration and their policies are affecting the communities. But I'm a comedian. It is really sad, but how about some jokes? Because that's the only way I can, you know.
If we don't take a moment to laugh about something, we're all going to self-destruct.
100%.
Matt Nair on air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about not just this trend, but this plain practice, this plain policy inside the present administration, including the U.S. Department of Justice, to terminate people we do not like, perhaps because their last name happens to be Comey, perhaps because they're in charge of ethics inside the Department of Justice, and apparently people like Mr. Terrell, who's been the ethics officer of the Department of Justice for a long time, doing an excellent job of providing ethical advice and counsel to members of the Department of Justice, top officials. He is no longer there. We got rid of him, too. Again, contrary to the law,
You cannot simply do this, but the president is showing them the door. We know as well that there are other terminations going on with respect to people who have previously been involved in the prosecutions of this president, the Mar-a-Lago case, the case involving January 6th. All of those prosecutors, about 20 of them, have recently been dismissed as well. Not on the merits, not for cause. They're not at-will employees, but they've been treated like that. They have been shown the door, and they are gone because of the justice work that they did in the past. We know as well that the assistant U.S. attorneys who handled those January 6th prosecutions, all of them in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., are likewise gone from our system because of the work that they did in support of the rule of law in America. It is a very troubling trend, and it continues seemingly unabated. Much of it at the hands also of a person named Emile Beauvais. He's still inside the Department of Justice in the Deputy Attorney General's office. He was the author of a lot of those firings early on. And he may well be, almost certainly will be, headed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit upon the nomination of this president to take on lifetime tenure in that appeals court just below the United States Supreme Court. In addition to those terminations, those purposeful movements to get rid of staff inside the Department of Justice, we also have simply departures. This significant coming out just this past week, the U.S. Department of Justice units called the Federal Programs Branch is charged with defending all of these policies and practices, the executive orders inside this administration, recently seeing departures of about 69 of 110 lawyers. That's about two-thirds of the entire staff there departing as a result of two things. One is overwork. They are simply deluged by all of these cases, can no longer handle it. But more importantly, defending cases that they feel they cannot defend. And that's the principal reason why they're leaving. One of them says, we have come to work at the Federal Programs Branch to defend aspects of our constitutional system. And how can we participate in this project of tearing it down? They are decimated by the kinds of things they're being asked to do in trying to represent factually, legally, to defend these executive orders for which there is no defense in the courts. And now you have nearly 70 of 110 of these attorneys walking out the door since Donald Trump was elected in November. Will they fill those positions? Sure they will. They will find attorneys to come in and do that defensive work. What is the downside of these firings and of the departures there? It is a huge, huge diminution in the expertise that is otherwise there inside the Department of Justice. You don't restore that overnight. And our Department of Justice in all of these areas and more is lessened by virtue of these departures of good, decent people handling their jobs apolitically without partisan perspective and being fired because of the work that they have done also in that apartisan, non-political way in the past. It is a reason for great concern. Finally, we've got the Epstein matter, Jeffrey Epstein matter that has captivated, seemingly, the United States of America. Let's begin with this general observation, as we always do. This is human tragedy, as always said. Every single criminal prosecution is human tragedy. This is no exception. At the top of the list, let us not forget that ultimately this case was prosecuted against Maxwell, who remains in federal custody in federal prison 20 years based upon her conviction for this human trafficking of individuals, victims of Epstein and Maxwell alike. They are out there. They are real live human beings. And this sideshow, this circus show that's going on right now involving the conspiracies, the unfounded conspiracies about unfounded conspiracies that's taken over Washington, that's got the deputy director of the FBI squabbling with the attorney general and with the director of the FBI in public and private. All of that, an embarrassment to government, especially when the core focus should have been and was upon the victims of this offense conduct. They're out there, and one can only wonder what they're thinking about how this has been turned in the public's view by virtue of what the president has done, recently now suing the Wall Street Journal to further exacerbate all of these conspiracies within conspiracies, prompting the New York Times to put together Venn diagrams to try to keep it all straight.
And along the way, directing his attorney general to seek the release of the grand jury transcripts. Here's a significant point about that. Under Rule 6C, that request may well not be granted by a district court judge who has to identify the law enforcement reasons for doing it. You don't release grand jury transcripts. There's a presumption that they will not be released, absent some law enforcement reason that is compelling and known based upon another piece of criminal investigative or prosecutorial work, some legitimate government reason, and not because it's a subject of late night talk shows and also a banter inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Highly likely that will not be granted. And beyond that, the grand jury transcripts themselves about the underlying conduct, they do not show, they will not reveal all of this recent intrigue. Once again, the unfounded conspiracies, inside the unfounded conspiracies about what the president calls a hoax, that's not in these grand jury transcripts, and it is a misnomer. It's a misdirection to say that somehow if these are released, we're going to get clarity on all these things that happen. I would offer that once again, this issue is tragedy. It's human tragedy for everybody involved. It is unfortunate that we are not talking about the larger issues facing America in Washington, D.C. and beyond, including right here in Wisconsin. We'll talk more about that and other matters affecting the rule of law and justice and government next weekend. Come back and be a part of that discussion at that time. My name is Jim Santel.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. At least 3 people are in critical condition and 30 are hurt after a vehicle plowed into a crowd in line outside of a Los Angeles nightclub. Police say one of the patients had a gunshot wound and an investigation is ongoing. Captain Adam Van Gerpen at the Los Angeles Fire Department.
On arrival, they found a large number of people waiting outside of a club. There was a vehicle who had drove through the people that were waiting in line. They drove through a taco stand, through a valet podium, and then through the crowd of people that were waiting to go inside.
President Trump is suing the Wall Street Journal for $10 billion over a story linking him to the late sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein amid a firestorm of questions. A spokesman for Dow Jones says it has full confidence in its reporting. CBS's Dick Brennan.
Trump has tried to downplay any friendship with the late convicted child sex offender. The administration released a memo last week